Well, thanks a lot, Donna Jo. Often say if you hang around long enough, there's only two things can happen. People forget about you entirely, or they terribly exaggerate what you've done. So maybe that's what's happened here. One aspect of the work that I introduced is that I wanted to base linguistic analysis and linguistic thinking on the way people actually speak in everyday life. And in so doing, I got involved in the topic of today, which is the language of life and death. Because in trying to get the flow of language that approaches the speech of everyday life, one technique is to get people to talk about things that are terribly important and meaningful to them. Not their general opinions, but what actually happened. So in our fieldwork, the key golden key message is, what happened, particularly? And then I wrote a paper back in 67 with a guy who was a high school student at the time, Joshua Waleski, called Narrative Analysis. And it has become a very solid part of the growing field of narratology, which crosses many, many departments. And this talk today is an advertisement for a book which is just about to appear from Cambridge University Press called The Language of Life and Death, The Transformation of Experience in Oral Narrative. And I'm going to do something today which I can't do in the book, which is I'm going to try to evoke the fundamental data that the book is based on, which is simply interest. What's interesting? So, back in 1963, I was interviewing a retired Jewish postman named Jacob Schissel in a brownstone house in New York City. And I asked him that question, did you ever in a spot where you thought yourself that you might be killed, that you said to yourself, this is it? And he said, yeah, my brother stuck a knife in my head. And I said, how'd that happen? And he said, like kids, you know, I get into a fight. I twisted his arm up behind him. This was just a few days after my father died. We were sitting in Shiva. And the reason the fight started, he saw a rat out in the yard. This was out in Coney Island. And he started to talk about it. My mother just sat down to have a cup of coffee. And I told him, cut it out. Of course, kids, you know, he don't have to listen to me. And that's when I grabbed his arm. I twisted up behind him. I let go of his arm. There was a knife on the table. He just grabbed it and let me have it. Started bleeding like a pig. Naturally, first thing, run to the doctor. The doctor says, just that much more, and you'd have been dead. So a few years later, I was in Columbus, Ohio. I was talking to a guy named Harold Shambaugh, who had been in the Merchant Marine, and I asked him a similar question. And he said, well, this was in Buenos Aires, in South America. And I said, what happened in South America? He said, I was sitting at a table drinking, and this Norwegian sailor came over and started giving me a bunch of junk how I was sitting with his woman. Everybody at the table were my shipmates. And I didn't want to bother with him. I just turned around and shoved him and said, I want to fool with you. Next thing I know, lying on the ground, blood all over me. The fellow said, don't move your head. Your throat's cut. Now, these techniques of interviewing were used by Tony Kroc when he expanded our study of Philadelphia to include the upper class. So one of the questions that we frequently ask people, Tony asked him, was there someone in your family who was famous for having a feeling that something was going to happen and it did happen? And this upper class person said, yes, there is an instance. Dad was being driven out from town by a chauffeur. This was a good many years ago. And he had the New York Times, and he read in the New York Times and noticed that the death of a person whom he knew, but he knew was a very close friend of George Jensen. Now, George Jensen lived in Chestnut Hill. So Dad said to the chauffeur, stop at Mr. Jensen's house on the way home because I want to commiserate with him. And so they did stop, and Dad went in, and Dad said, George, I'm sorry to hear about the death of, I don't remember his name. And George Jensen said, I don't know what you're talking about. If you died, I would have been one of the first people to know. And Dad said, well, it's in the newspaper. I'll go out to the car and get the newspaper. Went out, got the newspaper, come back. And he and George went through the newspaper, no sign of this death notice. And just as they were finished perusing it, the telephone rang from someone in New York telling George Jensen that, guess he died. But there was nothing in the newspaper. Dad brought the newspaper home. My sister, I guess George was home at the time, and I all went through the newspaper meticulously. Couldn't find anything. Now, we taught a, Gillian and I taught a class in 1973 in Michigan, the Linguistic Institute. And a number of our students went out to small towns in Michigan interviewing people. And one was Claire Galled. And she talked to an old man named Ross Hawkins. And he said, shall I tell you about the first man got killed by a car here? I can tell you that. For they really had cars in town. I think it was a judge, Sawyer. He was a judge. I understand he was a judge in Ann Arbor. He had a son that was a lawyer, and I saw a son. I guess must have got drunk, because he drove through town with a chauffeur with one of those old touring cars without open tops and everything, big cars, first ones. And then they come through the town and late in the night. They went pretty fast, I guess. They come out here to the end of the where the Pontiac Trail turns right or left in the road, and they couldn't make the turn. They turned left. They tipped over in the ditch. Steering wheel hit this fellow in the heart, the chauffeur. Killed him. And the other fellow just broke his thumb. The lawyer was drunk. They say a drunk man never gets it. I shouldn't say that. Might get in trouble. Anyway, they called up my dad. And I lived across from the city hall there, and he was justice of most of his life, justice of the peace, you know. And they says, Mr. Hawkins, we want you to get to Livery Barn and get Mr. Drury to get the, go out there and bring that man back to the funeral home or whatever you have to do. So my dad said, well, he let me go with him. Of course, I was over 12. I don't know how, probably 15 maybe. So we went out there. Picked up that man and a buckboard. Well, there was two men on the front seat, so I had to lay back there with that man. And his feet was flopping over the edge where the gate goes down, if there was any gate, and flopping. Turned black, because it stopped the circulation, you know. And I thought it was a Negro man. And boy, that was an eerie night for me, coming home in the dark with that man. Well, those four stories are what the book is about. They occupy the first, there's a chapter on escalation of violence, on confrontation with the dead, on premonitions, and information from passed on from the dead. And then there's a series of longer narratives, almost epic narratives from people telling about equally important things. And then it goes into epic narrative, the application of the study of the techniques of oral storytelling in epic, and then it asks the questions about historians. Do historians draw upon the same techniques that we use in the narratives of everyday speech? But the main datum of the book is what we have just been exposed to here. Frequently I say to a large audience, I'll say, I'm going to start telling a story, and right now, you're sitting and rustling and turning over a few pages and coughing and stuff like that. But as soon as I start the story, you will not do that. You'll just be sitting quietly. And after I stop, that silence will continue. And then I say, now I know you're thinking you're going to have some fun and drop a book in the middle of this and screw up this business. But it never happens. Never. And it's an eerie situation for me because I'm really telling you these stories as they've been told to me. This information is flowing through me. Those of you, how many of you have done acting? Yeah, a whole bunch of you. Well, you know, there's this strange situation where you're communicating with the audience. You don't know how it's doing it, but it's flowing through you to them. So what I want to understand is the fundamental datum is, why are these stories so interesting? What is interest all about? But there's a deeper approach to it, which I've put up here from Jerome Bruner, The Narrative Construction of Reality. Bruner says, we organize our experience and our memory of human happenings mainly in the form of narrative stories, excuses, myths, reasons for doing and not doing, and so on. Unlike the constructions generated by logical and scientific procedures that can be weeded out by falsification, narrative constructions can only achieve verisimilitude. Narratives, then, are a version of reality whose acceptability is governed by convention and narrative necessity, rather than by empirical verification and logical requiredness. In other words, it's a distinct form of truth. Now, since I'm gathering this data primarily in the interest of quantitative analysis of linguistic change and variation, this means that the study of narrative is going off on a different track. I'm not going to be presenting any quantitative data to you now about it. Instead, I'm going to try to understand two things. One, what makes the story so interesting? And secondly, how does the narrator manage to transform reality in his interest to present it in the best possible way? So Bruner contrasts this with another point of view, which I've just exposed you to. The illusion created by a skillful narrative that a story is as it is. It needs no interpretation. Now, when I was telling those stories, none of you had the feeling of, gee, I don't understand why this is happening. It just happens. You accept it. But when we look at it closely, and I've been looking at some of these stories for 40, 50 years, we keep getting deeper and deeper into it to understand the question of why did this happen, and how is the story told in such a way that it grabs our interest. There's a term that Bruner uses called hermeneutic composability, and for a long time I've been very skeptical about the term hermeneutic. It implies that there's a text or a text analog through which somebody's been trying to express a meaning and from which someone is trying to extract a meaning. But the hermeneutic analysis is done with a great deal of effort. Whereas what you got from the story is a transfer of experience which is presupposes or precedes that. But such hermeneutic interpretation is required when there's neither a rational method of assuring the truth of a meaning assigned to the text as a whole, nor an empirical method for determining the verifiability of the constituent elements that make up the text. In effect, the best hope of hermeneutic analysis is to provide an intuitively convincing account of the meaning of the text as a whole in the light of the constituent parts that make it up. And that's what I'm going to try to do today. Now, here is a map of the fields of narrative that the field of narratology deals with. Everything within a circle is linguistic. Everything outside the circle is non-linguistic. People who study narratology talk about how paintings tell stories, photography, photographic stories, as you're familiar with, and film, we realize, crosses the line between linguistic and non-linguistic presentation. But we'll be concerned here with oral narratives of personal experience. And I've got some subtypes of oral narratives which are excluded. Ballads, jokes, tall tales, dreams will be something we can consider. But outside of this, there is non-oral but written written materials that deal with autobiography, and of course fiction and history. So the examination of the techniques used for telling oral narratives of personal experience will be expanded to these other areas with the assumption that people do draw upon these fundamental notions. Now, one of the exercises we do in my class on narrative analysis is listen. And you might try that sometime. Just start eavesdropping as a profession. Maybe some of you already do. And ask yourself, what narratives occur in this conversation? What's the role of narratives? And there are two questions. One is, how many narratives occur in the middle of everyday conversation? And secondly, how do you get the right to tell a story? People who've studied conversational analysis are aware of the fact that most turns of talk are one sentence, one or two. When you're telling a story, a narrative, you need a lot more than that. So you have to let people know. And some of the observations that my students have made is like this. Person who wants to break in with a story says, no, wait. Okay. They do it with considerable effort. So how do you recognize, in that case, what is a narrative and what isn't? Now, there are lots of ways of doing it, and I have to confess to you that the particular approach that I take has not had much influence. If you go through the journal Narrative Inquiry, 50% of the articles make reference to Lvova-Vilevsky 67, but they don't start with the definition of narrative we have, which is a linguistic definition and deals with temporal organization. This is a minimal narrative. He hit me and I hit him. When you're in a narrative mode, that's asserting that first he hit me and then I hit him, and there lies between the two what we call a temporal juncture. As opposed to many, many other ways of telling that same story, like after he hit me, I hit him, or before I hit him, he hit me. Lots of ways in which these can be ordered, but the normal way in which you tell a story is to use finite tensed verbs which assert, by the fact that following a narrative rule, that the first occurred before the second. And this is the structural components that we've identified, and this has had a big influence. Most of the references to our work uses these terminology. First, you begin with an abstract. What's it about? My brother stuck a knife in my head. That was what it was about. And then we have an orientation section where we ask who, where, what, who are the participants, where are they, when, and what were they doing, normally with a progressive. And then we have the complicating action, which says, and then what happened, then what happened. So these are the questions that are being answered. And then an evaluation, which says why, but most importantly, it precludes, so what? Now the question, so what, is always in the background. It isn't used that often, but the threat of so what is overpowering. When you finish telling somebody about something that happened, the guy says, so what? You've lost the game. And then a resolution, how did it end? And then a coda, which precludes what happened. The coda says, and that was that. And I said, the guy who picked me up is a detective in Union City, and I see him every now and again. There are lots of ways in which you bring the story back to the present, the timeline back to the present. So we'll be talking about, besides these structural components, reportability and credibility, the polarization and integration of participants, the assignment of praise and blame, and the reconstruction of the causal chain of events. These are all elements in my approach to. Let's talk about reportability. A reportable event justifies the occupation of social time for an extended turn of talk. It controls the automatic reassignment of speaker role to the narrator. That is, it's not that you're going to be the only person who talks for the next 5 minutes. It's that if a person says, wow, gee, is that so, that the turn of talk automatically gets reassigned to you. And it's a narrative, the reportable event precludes the question, so what? Or in French, AP, Spanish, EK. It's less common than any other events in both the world and the story world. Has a greater effect upon the needs and desires of the participants in the narrative than non-reportable events. So though we come with the central thing in narrative analysis, the most reportable event. It's the event that's less common than any other, and has the greatest effect upon the needs and desires of the participants. So yeah, that's what the story is about. But the most reportable event is not the story. Now, we introduce another concept of credibility. In oral narratives of personal experience, credibility is essential to maintain the moral stance. If what you're telling is a lie, your moral stance is injured. To maintain the interest of the audience, audiences quickly turn aside from bullshit. The transfer of experience to the audience is lost. If you don't believe it happened, you don't. Now, the expectation of credibility doesn't apply to every story or narrative you hear. Jokes. This moose goes into a bar. Nobody is expecting a credibility. In fact, if you think it's credible, the joke is ruined. Because dreams. Now, this is a subtle matter. I think I could appeal to the audience here that there are probably many of you who have someone in your family who likes to tell their dreams, right? Now, how many of you find those dreams interesting? They're terribly interesting, the person telling it. But they're certainly not interesting to most of us. And there will be some exceptions to that when we talk about dreams of premonitions. But generally speaking, you don't challenge a person's dream by saying, "I don't believe you dreamed that." No. Tall tales, by definition, are not supposed to be credible. And ballads, song ballads, which were often narrative in form. So in fiction, credibility is replaced, as we saw before, by verisimilitude, the things that happen. And as I was talking to Donna Jo before, I was reading Henry Fielding, one of his many wonderful books addressed to the reader, and he says that the most important thing in writing is that your characters behave in a way that is normal for them given the character they have. It's no excuse to argue, "But this actually did happen." Rather, a fiction writer has to write about things that you expect to happen, but I think, as Donna Jo said, makes you believe in the believability of it. But there is now an inverse relationship of reportability and credibility. The more reportable, the less credible. And that's the fundamental dynamic that drives narratives. As reportability increases, credibility goes down. And yet to get to people's attention, you want to assert that this is an unusual reportable event. Now, probably the major theme that I'm going to put in front of you today is the fact that there is another dimension here called objectivity. And credibility increases with objectivity. Now, I'll illustrate this. You can illustrate this in many ways. But the opposite of objectivity is subjectivity. And there are many storytellers, people tell stories, who respond to the therapeutic impulse to expose your emotions, to analyze your emotions, to discuss your emotions, to speak how you feel. And what we find is that a person in the midst of a story says, "Oh, and I was so terrified, I even wake up thinking about it, and every time I speak to my analyst about it, he says, 'You haven't recovered from this fact.'" That will be opposed to techniques that are more objective, which are illustrated by some of the stories that I told you before. So what is the scale of objectivity? On the least objective, "I still remember how scared I was." Next is, "You actually said yourself, 'This is it. At least I..." "The doctor said just that much more and you'd have been dead." A third person witness is frequently a policeman, a doctor, a person who is in a good position to judge whether this is true or not, but he's not involved in your emotions. This last one was from a story about a plane that was going over Mexico City. It had left Mexico City, was trying to climb the mountain. How many of you have been to Mexico City? You know those big mountains all around it? It's surrounded by mountains. And this plane wasn't making it. It was losing altitude and heading towards the mountains. And the person telling the story said you could hear the prayer beads going in the back of the plane. The sound of those prayer beads is extremely convincing. Or in another story, a man who's his wife had a crush on the narrator, and she left a note saying she was going to commit suicide on account of me. He came into my hotel. Nice big blue 44, too. So the object speaks more clearly than emotion. Well, in trying to analyze narrative, we start with the fact that there is a logical analysis here that have no empirical basis for what's going to follow here. Instead, it's logical. Even though hermeneutics says that we don't have logical proof, every narrator must answer the question, where shall I begin? Every time you start to tell a story, you have answered that question. And then that is a key point for a jumping off point for what we call the reconstruction. A decision to tell a narrative begins with the selection of the most reportable event. You have to decide what you're going to tell a story about, and you're going to select the most reportable event. Now, the narrative is not a telling of this MRE. That could be like an abstract, as I said before. Brother stuck a knife in my head. But before beginning, the narrator must locate an event prior to the most reportable event, which bears a causal relationship to it, and answers the question, why did this happen? So, my brother stuck a knife in my head, why? This process proceeds recursively until an event is located which precludes the question, why did that happen? Because it's an ordinary event. I was sitting with my shipmates drinking. Why? You see, when the question, you've arrived at the point where the question, why did that happen, is stupid, then you have a good starting point. That forms the orientation of the narrative. It's the least reportable event. I'm telling a story, it's not about how we were sitting drinking. Now, this is what the schema for reconstruction looks like. You start with E sub 0, most reportable event. Ask why is that? Prior event, E minus 1, E minus 2, and you continue back until you come to this orientation section, where to start. Now, it turns out that the orientation is least interesting, but the most important in the decision as to how to tell the story, as we'll see. Now, the credibility of the most reportable event depends upon the credibility of the hierarchical chain of causal connections leading to the maximally credible and least reportable event. This is a logical necessity. Now, there's a basic assumption for my approach to reconstruction. Reconstruct is an attempt to figure out how the person told the story and what lies behind it. First of all, I'm assuming the speaker's not lying. Now, you may say that's absurd. People lie. But the assumption is based upon because lying is difficult. It often requires a readjustment of the entire series of events to be sure they're consistently motivated. Lying is dangerous. You never know. Many of you have practiced lying. You know it's never dangerous because you don't know what else has to be adjusted to make that lie go. You never know what other witnesses or other accidents will bring the inconsistency to light, with consequent loss of credibility and damage to your moral position. But lying is unnecessary. That's the main point. A whole analysis of narrative shows that there's no reason to lie, because there's so many other more effective ways to transform events to achieve the desired results. Now let's look at the Norwegian sailor story, and we raise the question, why did this guy cut Shambo's throat? So we're going to look at the polarization of participants. And one thing we noticed in evaluation is the role of negatives. I don't want to fool with you. That contrasts this, the negative contrasts the real world with the possible world. And the study of possible worlds is the study of the evaluation of the real world. Guy told me, says, don't move your head. Because if you move your head, then you're dead. So that's an approach to evaluation I want to call your attention to, but that's not the main topic. The Norwegian sailor cut Shambo's throat with a knife and reconstruct it. Why? Because Shambo refused to listen to him. Why? Because his complaint that Shambo was sitting with his woman was nonsense, a bunch of junk, he said. Why? Because Shambo was sitting at a table drinking with his shipmates. So that's my reconstruction of the chain of causality which lies behind the story which you heard. Now, we're interested in the linguistic devices that people use to transform that chain of events into one that is more reasonable from the point of view of the narrator. So another way to look at it is, Shambo was sitting at a table drinking with the shipmates, so the Norwegian sailors complained he was sitting with a woman was nonsense, so Shambo refused to listen to him, so the Norwegian sailor cut Shambo's throat with a knife. Still doesn't, even though you heard it and you understand that chain of causality, the movement from E minus 1 to E 0 is just too big a jump. There's a key word which will be one of the linguistic peculiarities we'll be looking at in this analysis. Kept. He kept giving me a bunch of junk. Narratives are about particular events, but kept is a quasi-modal which implies that there's more than one event continued here. And so we rewrite this event saying the Norwegian sailor complained that Shambo was hitting his woman. Shambo refused to listen to the first time he complained. He refused to listen to the second time he complained. The third time he complained. So kept is a way of condensing or limiting the fact that this was a repeated complaint. And in a study of how the question that we're raising here is a general study, I have a paper called Speech Actions and Reactions, which raises the question, when do words turn into violence? A crucial question. When do people stop talking and begin killing? And this is part of the answer. Shambo is behaving as if this person is a non-human and is not listening to him no matter how time he repeats. And I've got a lot of ethnographic data about bar scenes. But what it shows is that he kept giving me a bunch of junk implies that there were at least two and possibly more events in which each time he refused to listen to the person. Let's look at another question. The brother who almost killed Schissel by stabbing him with a knife. What kind of person was he? I ask people that question. He must be a pretty evil guy if he tried to kill his brother. But nobody says that. They'll say, well, kind of uncontrolled. And one of the things that Schissel's story does is to integrate the participants by removing certain actions. Let's look and see how that's done. At 10, he says, I told him to cut it out. Of course, kids, you know, he don't have to listen to me. That's a key interjection. Because if we reconstruct the story, my brother picked a knife up and stabbed me with it because I grabbed his arm and twisted it up behind him because he said what? There's no record of what his brother said. Instead, we have an excuse. He said, you don't have to listen to me. Because I told him to stop talking. Because he started to talk about the rat. So what happens in this story is that an excuse is substituted. We don't hear the brother speak. This is the most reportable event. So that excuse, you don't have to listen to me, prevents us from hearing what the brother said that was so provoking that it led the first act of violence, which is to grab his arm and twist it up behind him. So it's a reasonable hermeneutic assumption to say that what his brother said is, I don't have to listen to you. It frequently happens when you elide an utterance, an action, you leave behind it evidence as to what was said. So my view of this matter was, originally, it was a struggle between Cain and Abel. That's what it's about. And in matters of great emotional stress, people behave violently. So my explanation for the story was to say, around his father's death, there was a great deal of emotional trauma, and anything could trigger off violence. But I came to the conclusion that was wrong. And this is perhaps persuasive. But really, this is a picture not of Cain and Abel, but of Jacob and Esau, of Isaac and Esau. I'm not sorry, Isaac and Jacob. This is Jacob, who is bringing a offering to his blind father, Isaac. And Isaac is feeling his arms and saying, the hands are the hands of Esau, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. What Jacob was doing is trying to steal his brother's birthright. And he did succeed. He received his father's blessing by assuming that he was Esau. What justification is for that? Well, this is a purely hermeneutic approach. In addition, we expand because he said, I don't have to listen to you too. You're not my father. I don't have to listen to you. And just a persuasive interpretation. But it goes along with a deeper look at what it means to be sitting Shiva. Those who are familiar with the custom know that it's custom involving many, many features of Jewish life. For 7 days you sit at home. You don't do any cooking. People bring in food. Turn the mirrors to the wall. Don't wear leather shoes. No laundry. No work. And what do you talk about? Turns out that's a big issue. If you go on the internet, you'll see rabbis writing columns giving people advice as to what to talk about when you're sitting Shiva. There's inappropriate things to say. Talking about a rat is not one of the things you can do. But I think it's similar to the analysis of the Norwegian sailor, because it implies that there were a series of events and that the orientation starts only with the last of them. That throughout this period we can assume that Jacob has to be the same name as the biblical Jacob. That Jacob was continually telling his brother what to do. And in the course of grief, it's not the first time he said, you can't take my father's place, I don't have to listen to you. And that gives us some sense of what the power of the emotional conflict is that led to this event. Let's turn to the first man killed by a car here. In this case, we don't have an integrating approach, but we have the assignment of blame. Now reflect, if you remember that story about this drunken lawyer who drove through town with a chauffeur about 60 miles an hour, middle of the night, the big old touring cars. So you remember him. So this is the part we're concerned with, and the key word is, one key word is he must have got drunk. This story is being told by Ross Hawkins, who is 71 years old, and he's remembering, he must have got drunk is a modal of well down in the Euryalus category. It doesn't mean that he did get drunk. But most importantly enough, he drove through town with a chauffeur. This is one of the linguistic devices that people use to assign agency and responsibility. Who was responsible for this terrible event? Well, there's another linguistic device, they. They came through town late at night. They went pretty fast. They came out. They couldn't make the turn. They turned left. They tipped over in the ditch. All this is assigning agency to both of them. So the picture you get is this lawyer is saying, faster, faster, you son of a bitch! And I'll fire you if you don't drive faster. When in fact, he was probably asleep in the back of the car. But the semantics of drive are interesting and show that people can consciously or unconsciously make use of peculiarities of the language. What does push mean? It means cause something to move transversely, right? And drive, in the most usual sense, is to cause a machine to move transversely, like driving a car or driving a lawnmower. But there's a second meaning of drive, which is to cause a person to drive, like he marched the men around the room. To cause a person to cause a machine to move. And it's that second meaning of drive which is being called up to assign agency to the lawyer. The lawyer drove through town with the chauffeur. So this is a little bit of empirical data that's fun to look at. We've asked a number of people, my current class, in response to reading that story, who was to blame? Who was driving? Who was killed? Who was to blame? 18, almost 50% of the people said the lawyer was to blame. 19 said the chauffeur, and 4 assigned it to both. Who was driving? Only 5 people got it backwards. It was driving. How could he be driving? So even though, and who was killed? Even though so, there are 7 people who got mixed up about who was killed. But it was clear that the effect of this assignment of agency means that at least half of the people are blaming the lawyer, as the narrator was doing, because this is a morality play. This is a small town, South Lyon. There's about 3,000 people there. And the picture you get is this big city lawyer from Ann Arbor who is foolishly throwing his life away, putting other people in danger, getting the chauffeur killed, getting drunk, can't handle his own affairs, and has this rich old Rio touring car. On the other hand, what have you got is a justice of the peace with a buckboard, hasn't got a car, who has to go out and save this other person, and if not save him, clean up the damage. So it's clear that that's what we're dealing with here. But I'm going to skip. I'd like to move to another the story of the New York Times. And we're talking about the credibility of the most reportable event. This is the story as I read it. And the key thing I want to talk to is that the narrative syntax is quite simple and quite straightforward until we come to E0, the big event. And just as they were finished perusing it, a telephone rang from somebody in New York telling George Jensen that guess he died. Now, the problem with all such premonition stories is the credibility. And the credibility here is challenging, and yet there are devices that make it difficult to deal with. I'm a skeptic. But I don't have the answer as to how you explain these events. But some of the credibility that comes about to it is assigned to the fact that this is the structure of the very complex sentence that's arranged, a very informal structure. Just as they were finished perusing it, is a time, establishes the time of the event, and that gets foregrounded, as often happens at the beginning of the sentence. The telephone rang from someone in New York telling George Jensen, I guess he died. And the structure of that sentence is what carries much of the impact of the story. When I read that or tell that sentence, it carries a lot of weight. The telephone is doing the speaking. The telephone is the active agent. The telephone rang, telling him, right? From someone in New York telling him. And the particular power of this sentence is the fact that the inanimate object is like is giving credibility. Now, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about a historical text, because I want to illustrate that some of the same techniques are used by historians, particularly historians who indulge themselves in the 19th century passion for narrative. Many of you are familiar with Queen Elizabeth's death in her last years, particularly because Lord Essex, her favorite, proved to be a traitor and had to be executed. And this is by S.T. Bindolf, the great historian of Tudor England, a Penguin book. And it fits in with our theme of the language of life and death. She brooded on the past, and above all on that cruel tragedy which had robbed her Essex of his life and her life of him. In June 1602, she told the French ambassador that there was nothing which could give her any enjoyment. And when 6 months later, her godson Harrington came to court, he was moved to grief by her show of human infirmity. By then, indeed, the end was near. It came at Richmond in Surrey on the bleak and windy March of 1603. The death of yet another close friend, the Countess of Nottingham, induced a fit of melancholy, which in turn brought on serious illness. Unable to eat or sleep, the Queen refused either to take physics or to go to bed. For a fortnight, she lay huddled on her cushions in silent misery. Within her chamber, all was deathly silence. But without, all was bustle and activity. Sir Robert Cecil was putting the finishing touches to his plans for bringing in her successor. Sir Robert Carey posting horses all along the route to Holyrood, that's the Scottish seat of government, to speed himself north with the tidings. At Richmond, there still stands the gate, spared by the German bomb which damaged the courtyard within, where in the early hours of that 24th of March, Carey waited for the signal which had sent him galloping away. Between 2 and 3 o'clock, a light appeared. A door was open. Whispered words were spoken. Then Carey mounted and was gone. And the hoofbeats which told his departure were the knell of Tudor England. Now, I've chosen Bindolf because he's not only a narrator, but he's a master of English language. So the last sentence carries a great deal of weight. But there's an interesting question about this, which is similar to a question raised by Eric Auerbach in Mimesis, why Homer frequently interrupts the story with long, almost irrelevant detail. How the hell do we justify, at Richmond there still stands the gate, going back to the 20th century, spared by the German bomb which damaged the courtyard within? Why does the author bring in the gate in the midst of telling what happened when Elizabeth died? Now, one of the problems we have with historical narrative is summed up in the famous sentence, "Were you there, Charlie?" How does he know that between 2 and 3 o'clock a light appeared? The door was open. Whispered words were spoken. He didn't hear them. No one reported them. It's a reconstruction, but it's reinforced by a number of particular objects. A light, a concrete object, a door, whispered words, and most importantly, hoofbeats. Hoofbeats are this inanimate sound, which adds to credibility. But more importantly, the gate. You can see that. You can go there and see that gate. I'm not kidding you. Go right to London, and there it stands, still, just where he was waiting to get the word to carry the information about Elizabeth's death and who was to be next king of England. So this technique of using inanimate objects is not uncommon. In another chapter of the book dealing with the death of Absalom, in the David son Absalom. After the Absalom is killed, the author says, and there is a tower. Since Absalom had no children, there was a tower made in his memory, and it still exists today. You can see this. So even though I don't have evidence for how Joab killed Absalom, you can go and see Absalom's tower to this day. Well, sum up, I've been talking about a number of ways that we can understand how narratives of personal experience are constructed to produce the effect which I started out with, which is to be able to hold your attention. Now, to a certain extent, it's a real problem, both for the book and for me, because I'm upstaged by the stories I'm talking about. Nothing I can say can be as interesting as they are. So it's a continual struggle against the inherent interest. But to understand them gives a certain degree of satisfaction. So we start by saying narratives are initiated by a remembered chain of causal relations that link the most reportable event to the least reportable. That chain has to exist in memory. Narratives are constructed as a temporal sequence of events in the order that they were experienced. Narrative construction responds to an inverse relation of reportability to credibility in three ways. Reportability is maximized through irrealis predicates, negatives. That was the main contribution of Lvov and Walewski, 67. Negatives, modals, irrealis predicates, which don't talk about what happened, but compare what might have happened, what could have happened, what didn't happen, with what actually did happen. Credibility is maximized through realis predicates. You give voice to animate and inanimate third-person witnesses. So giving voice to these stones, these guns, these gates, allows them to speak. And then narratives assign reportability for the events narrated by linguistic devices that expand and contract degrees of activity, including repetition and elision. And those are some of the examples I've given. Now, as we go through this chain of events that are illustrating a particular narrative, I can't tell you, expect to find a zero causative verb drive. I can't tell you, expect to find a permissive let. Expect to find a keep. There are all kinds of peculiarities, idiosyncratic characteristics of the language you're dealing with, which narrators instinctively, unconsciously make use of to determine their point. And it's fun, it's interesting to discover what they are. And empirically, we can always do experiments to change them, as I've done in a few cases, where you alter that particular device to see what the effect upon the listener will be. But the fundamental operations require, well, let me explain the term hermeneutic composability. I spoke to someone who knows more about this than I do, and composability doesn't mean composability, it means compatibility. Hermeneutic explanations imply that there is an explanation which is competing with other explanations in a way that makes it impossible to say which one is right. May one be more persuasive than the other. So the truth of a meaning assigned to the text as a whole. So when I talked about the interpretation of Jacob Chisel's narrative, I was looking to see how many people said, yeah. There was a significant number of people in the room nodded their head, yeah. So persuasiveness is the heart of the matter. In effect, the best hope of hermeneutic analysis is to provide an intuitively convincing account of the meaning of the text as a whole in the light of the constituent parts that make it up. So I'm footnoting Bruner here to indicate that the major message of his approach to narrative is that narrative is a way in which we conceive reality. It's a screen through which we perceive the world. We're storytellers all, and we make a story. Now, you've noticed that in the word narrative now being used in hundreds of ways that have nothing to do with what I've been talking about. There was one story about the Phillies and all the major league teams. They have a narrative, which is just a little paragraph telling how good or bad they're doing. Narrative is used in hundreds of different ways, but this original way, which is based upon what people do in telling in everyday conversation, is fundamental. And but beyond that, I'm faced with this quotation. The illusion created by skillful narrative that a story is as it is and needs no interpretation. Because even though you may understand the story of Jacob Chisel or the story of the Norwegian sailor better, because I've talked about it in a while, doesn't increase the impact of the story. Its fundamental interest lies in the fact that it stretches our notion of what human beings can do. It enlarges our concept of what humanity is like. And every time you hear a story, you say, my God, did this happen? You're learning more about human race and what it's capacities are. Okay, that's it.